This is Radical Love Life, an ongoing series of podcasts and special events where we explore faith outside the boxes. Hosted by Mark Dilcom and Kelly Wilson. So, hey, Kelly.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
I'm freaking awesome. And you?
I am really, really good. It is a beautiful day.
It is a beautiful day. I like it, even though it's a little chilly.
Yep. Yep. But it's, I'm recording, as people watching this can see, I'm recording from home. I've got all these beautiful trees outside. Leaves are falling. It's like total autumn suburbia out here. So I'm enjoying it quite a bit.
Great. Great. Did you have a good Halloween as well?
Yes. Yes. My kiddo went to a Halloween party last night, which was, I was really glad to see her socializing, and nice. And I got to be dad taxi. So
great! It's always
good. Did you do Halloween?
We did. We celebrated a friend's birthday down in the village. Had some fabulous food, and then we walked over and watched the village Halloween parade, which is always a spectacle.
Stunning! I love that parade.
It was a great time. So
very wild. So what are we talking about today?
Well, my friend, we have a special guest. Andrew Whitehead is joining us today. Hey, Andrew.
Hey there. How are you?
Awesome. Good to have you on here.
Yeah, thank you.
So for our listeners, let's give a little bit of a bio on Andrew, because he's bringing something to the table here. So Andrew, it says here you are the Associate Professor of Sociology at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, where you co-direct the Association of Religious Data Archives at the Center for the Study of Religion and American Culture. That's quite a bit there.
Yeah, keeps me busy.
It does. And also, this we're going to talk a little bit about your book that I have in my hand, American Idolatry, right now. But you also co-authored another book as well, Taking America Back for God, Christian Nationalism and the United States as well, correct?
Yeah. That was my first book that I co-authored with Sam Perry.
Right on.
Mine. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. So as we were talking a little bit before as we started the episode, it's a great read. First thing is you dig right in there and you talk about your background and where you grew up. So As you say, you grew up in a small Midwestern town with one stoplight and a blinking light as you go out of town. So tell us a little bit about your spiritual roots in that.
Yeah, definitely. So I grew up in Northern Indiana. So in a really rural community. So it was farming and manufacturing and I was looking up some census data a while back on the town, and over the last 80 years, it's hovered between 1,500 and 2,000 people. Like, it's never grown above that. It's never gone under that. It's just right in that spot. And so everybody kind of knows everybody else. And, you know, a lot of the community is very similar, both in faith and, you know, outlook and community and neighborliness. And all these things were just a key part of growing up there. And this is too where my faith was formed in a lot of ways. So going to church, you worship alongside people that you interact with in other spheres, whether they're your middle school teacher or electrician or florist or whatever else. And just kind of how we saw ourselves, you know, as Christians and as Americans, these were tightly intertwined. There wasn't a lot of space between those, right? They just kind of seamlessly wove together. And to be one was to be the other, and to be a good person was to kind of embrace both those identities. And yeah, this was kind of where I grew up. And for me, you know, I had good experiences growing up in the church. I was welcomed, and it was a warm, inviting place. And I knew I was cared for in those spaces. And that's what really formed me. And I think it's just been on the journey, you know, getting older and leaving to go to college and elsewhere and other life experiences where, you know, I started to see some of kind of the cracks in the veil, you know, of growing up there, where recognizing that my experience of the church, you know, in white evangelicalism isn't the same experience that others have had, whether they're, you know, different skin color or gender or sexuality or whatever else. than me. And so that's kind of what started, you know, well, why is it different for other folks? And then, you know, learning some of the history of the country I grew up in, where there's a lot of wonderful things about being born here by historical accident, right? I didn't get to choose to be American. I was just born here. But alongside the good things, there are a lot of really dark aspects of our history. And so learning those too and wrestling with, well, what does that mean, right? If this is a Christian nation, let's say, or if Christianity is always working for the good, well, then why are so many Christians supporting different things throughout our history that clearly are not good? And so it's kind of, I guess, to kind of, you know, pull it all together, it's really recognizing that the beliefs and values that I was handed were good and true and right, but how those were lived out, I saw differences there, or who had access to those, or really to kind of, you know, go back to the who Jesus was talking with the parable of the Good Samaritan, right? The question of, well, who is my neighbor, right? That's what it came down to. We love and we care and we are neighborly, but how broadly, right, does that apply? And how deeply do we have to engage in that? I think that is a lot, or where a lot of the wrestling happens. So yeah, that's a bit of my story and kind of the path that I've been on and continue to be on, and that I try to invite people into with this book to begin to wrestle with some of these things wherever they're at on their journey.
Great response. You did mention the book, and I also mentioned it in the intro there, that the first book that you wrote, Taking America Back for God. So this is not your first time talking about Christian nationalism. So maybe if for us that are not familiar with the first book that you co-authored, tell us a brief bit about that. And then why did you write the second book?
Yeah. So Taking America Back for God was a book, again, that I wrote with Sam Perry. And we're both sociologists, social scientists, and we study American religion, religion in the United States, and how it both shapes and is shaped by, right, this context. And what we found professionally as we analyzed survey data, for instance, is that above and beyond whether somebody identified as Republican or Democrat, or above and beyond whether they went to church every week or affiliated with evangelical Protestantism or a mainline Protestant group, above and beyond how often they prayed or read their Bible, when we could figure out how strongly they believed the U.S. should be Christian and distinctively Christian, it told us something extra about how they saw the world. So it wasn't just politics and it wasn't just personal religion, but it was kind of this overlap, this melding of public expressions of religion that really told us a lot about how Americans see their social worlds, how they vote, how they act, who they support, who they don't support, who gets, you know, full access to civil liberties and who does not. And so what we found over and over in our studies was that this was telling us something new. And so that really encouraged us to write that first book, to write to a broad audience, but to lay out the social scientific evidence of what Christian nationalism is, defining it, looking at how widespread it is across the American public, and then to look at, well, what is it associated with, right? When we're looking at politics or different important topics like immigration or religious diversity or, you know, gender ideology or sexuality in the U.S., all these different topics, you know, what does it kind of predict when we know Americans either reject it or embrace it? So in that book, we're really trying to lay out, you know, to a popular audience, just exactly what the social science says. And so then for this book, it really does kind of flow out of, you know, one or two paragraphs in the conclusion that I wrote for the first book, where I highlight the threat that Christian nationalism poses to American Christianity, that it does threaten democracy, and we can talk about that too, but also that it embraces, you know, a vision of relating to our neighbors, to others around us, where we want power over them rather than trying to serve them or to seek the good for those people around us, no matter how different they are. And so in that sense, trying to point out in those two paragraphs, and then for this book, expanding it, that there are expressions of Christianity that I think lead to a common good and a flourishing for all people, that that's the gospel that Jesus was preaching. And I kind of highlight Luke 4, right? His first recorded, speaking the gospel for the first recorded time, you know, that he's highlighting the good of all, and that the kingdom of God coming and us being a part of that has real implications for how we relate to one another. And Christian nationalism, what we find over and over in the social science is that it outright pulls us in the opposite direction. It is not about the good of all or a common flourishing. It's really focused on the good for a few, right? And that only a few flourish. And so this book really kind of expands on that.
You know, one phrase that I see coming up several times in the book, at least early on, and I have a feeling it's reflected in your earlier book, is quality data or quality research. Because I just want to point out to our listeners who might be thinking of this in terms of, you know, our current news environment, often editorial content comes across as fact, but that you're really working with some actual scientific quality data.
Yeah.
Can you just expand on that a little bit, just so we know what this is based on? It's not just opinion.
Right. Yeah. No, I really appreciate you bringing that up. Yeah. This is based on a number, probably by this time, you know, 8 to 10 national surveys of the American public. Right. And so we're gathering data according to the social scientific methods of our field. And much of our work, which now is, you know, probably close to 20 to 30 peer-reviewed articles in journals where other sociologists are reviewing those, and then they are published. And so it goes through that peer review process. And so that is, I think, really important to highlight, is when we define Christian nationalism or talk about what it's associated with, we're bringing the methods of the field of social science to bear on it. And so, yeah, we're not just kind of pulling it out of thin air or thinking this is what we think it is. We're able to show empirically that this is what it is and this is what it's associated with. And I think that's really important then too, you know, with this, with American Idolatry, this book where I write, you know, to a Christian audience as a Christian, trying to share what I've learned and what I know, that this flows from that foundation of social science, but that it has something to say to us about how our faith is lived out. And so, yeah, I think, you know, Mark, we mentioned this earlier, the end notes, right? The things in the back of the book that you don't have to read, but if you really want to follow the trail, you can go there and it's going to show you the studies that I'm citing from, and you can follow that. And so as an academic, I really take that seriously, of giving credit to the ideas of other academics or people I've read. But then too, it should hopefully build up a trust where folks know that, you know, I'm not just making this up out of thin air, but it's based on, research and writing, of the highest kind. So
I got all kinds of questions over here, but I'm full of them. One of the things, you know, that you, when you talk about being a Christian, talking to Christians, is that, having come up in an evangelical background myself, I know that there are a lot of Christians who, when you say Christianity, they have a very specific idea of what the gospel means. Yeah. And it tends to be about personal salvation, about, you know, kind of hunkering down until the end times.
Yeah.
You know, those aspects. And you talk about personal salvation a little bit, but you also talk about social justice. And, I just wondered if you could talk about how you hold those things together, the relationship between those. Because I've been in churches where it's all about every service has to have an altar call for personal salvation. And I've been in churches where everything is a call to justice and you don't really talk about your personal relationship with Jesus. What's the relationship between those two?
Yeah, no, I share that experience, as you said, where growing up, when we talk about the gospel and define it, a lot of times it's according to one example is the Romans Road, right? So there are five or six passages from Romans, and you walk a person down this path to show them that they've sinned and fallen short of you know, God's design for them, that Jesus came to pay that price. They need to accept that. And if they do, then when they die, they will be forgiven and be able to enjoy eternity, right, with God. And so this is a very spiritualized view of it, but also very individualized, right? And I think that's where growing up within white evangelical spaces, especially, and this is true across, I think, white Christianity in the U.S., it does tend to lean that way, just very individualized. It's between you and God. And it isn't as though that it's not true or not a part of it, right? It can be personal, but I think it really ignores, when we just individualize it, it really ignores this broader point that I think Jesus was making. So again, pointing to Luke 4, his first, you know, the first time Jesus is preaching in the synagogue, where he's saying that he has come to bring good news to the poor, to the oppressed, to the blind, to those marginalized, those being crushed. And, you know, a lot of folks, especially white evangelicals, like to say we read our Bibles literally. And so, but when they look at this, they'll not read it literally. They'll say, well, it's spiritually oppressed, right? Spiritually poor. But that isn't in the text, right? So when we're really looking at the poor, the oppressed, the marginalized, those who are in chains, I think that it means, yes, there is a personal aspect. There's also an aspect of the gospel where God's kingdom coming has to has implications for how we relate to one another, right? And the systems and structures that organize our lives that do cause certain groups to be oppressed, to suffer. And that it isn't just, you know, one person suffering, but that they're a part of a community that maybe, you know, doesn't have the ability or the access to flourishing as our society is structured. And so that's where I think these things have to work in tandem. There is a personal aspect to Christianity, but it is located within this communal understanding that God has something to say and the kingdom of God has something to say about how we relate to one another. And being aware of that, I think, is part of what it means to be Christian. Similar to in the early church, when there were a group of widows who were being mistreated, and they brought that to the apostles, and the apostles took it seriously. They heard the cries of those who were being oppressed, and they said, we need to fix this. So the system and how it was designed was pushing some to the outer edges, right? They were suffering. But those early Christians, they listened to those cries of the marginalized and did something about it. And so I think that's the similar, for me on this journey, what I'm, you know, I feel we should be called to as Christians in the U.S. is not just focusing on the personal aspect, but recognizing that we're a part of how we relate to one another. And then realizing too, with our history, when we just individualize the gospel, it allows us to put up blinders and to stay either ignorant or just not be aware of the cries of the oppressed, because we think Christianity only has to do with me and my relationship, some sort of vertical and not a horizontal relationship. And so I think that's a real danger too. It's not only what we failed or what we're doing, but what we fail to do and who we fail to hear. And so, yeah, these are things that I wrestle with in the book and try to lay out, that the gospel is both personal, but it is collective, and it has something to say about how we relate to one another.
Thank you for that. That's some great insights about the kingdom.
Yeah, it is. Thank you.
Yeah.
So, Andrew, I want to turn to the book, American Idolatry, and you kick it off in your preface with what are seven difficult questions. And that kind of hit me right between the eyes, because you're absolutely right. All of these are questions that we need to ask ourselves. So let's dig into these a bit. And the first one you ask is, if our nation was built on Christian principles, why do our forebears treat Native Americans so viciously? What are some committed to ignoring this history today?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're wrestling with a lot of this right now, right? With what histories are taught and who gets to talk about those and what implications do those have for us? And so for me, early on in school, we learned a little bit about, before the U.S. was founded or soon after, what it was like for those coming to these shores and the people that they, you know, interacted with and engaged with, and then ultimately what we did to push them off land, or, you know, a lot of the death and destruction of those communities that took place. And wrestling with that, if this was if the narrative is that we used to be a Christian nation, we need to get back to that, well, then that has implications, because if those were Christians doing that, and they were, what does that tell us, right? And how are they relating? And is that a way that we're supposed to relate to others? So what else could be going on here? I think, yeah, that was an early question for me that really highlighted there's something else happening, right? It isn't just Christianity, but we're adding in these other cultural values that I think tend to pull people away from an expression of the gospel that seeks the good of those around us rather than our own comfort or our own power.
Yeah, well said. And we are seeing some awareness and recognition to that, at least in Canada. Mm-hmm. There's been a call to the Catholic Church and the Anglican Church up there. We have a little bit of it going on here in the U.S. where we realize that we came in to Indigenous people's lands, took it away from them, and then did our very best to destroy their culture and assimilate them into the way we wanted them to be.
Right.
So, and that we cannot ignore our reality. It's not like, you know, this is some version of somebody's history. This is what did happen. So, and we'll have to reconcile to that someday, which kind of goes into the second point that you make, mm-hmm. which is another travesty. And that is, you ask, if Christian theology is so profoundly shaped our national values of liberty, human rights, and full equality, why did even the most devout Christian citizens enslave Africans, ripping them from their land and destroying their lives and families? Mm-hmm. Why did our political leaders and the people who supported those leaders bar Black Americans from the full rights of citizenship so long? Why do Black Americans continue to face hurdles today? Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I think, too, it's wrestling with that history. So I think, you know, social science does such a great job at helping us see and understand where we're at right now, right? We can gather data and I can look at how these different views are associated with one another, or look at how life operates in this moment, the systems, right, that guide our lives. But that doesn't happen by accident, right? And so good history is so important. And I just, yeah, it's been such a key part of my professional and personal growth is reading good history to understand the choices that were made, you know, when way back when, or maybe not so long ago, that serve to structure our life now. Those ripples continue. And I think it isn't as though we are personally responsible for making those choices that resulted in a society that we live in now that is racialized. And by that, it means when we say a society is racialized, that that different racial and ethnic groups have different experiences in this society. And that is borne out by empirical data. There's no arguing that the maternal health rate is different for white and Black women. There's no arguing that racial minorities have a different experience with the criminal justice system or the death penalty. We can't argue those facts. And so when we live in a racialized society like that, again, it doesn't happen by accident. And it isn't as though I personally created this racialized society, but I have inherited it. And so now the question becomes, well, what am I going to do with that inheritance, right? It's similar to, I've heard one writer describe it as you inherited a hotel from your grandparents, let's say. And when they built the hotel, they had steps up to it, but no ramps or anything. Well, now there are folks in wheelchairs that would love to use the hotel, but they can't get up the steps. So as I inherit this hotel, I didn't personally choose to just have steps, but I see the problem before me, right? I recognize that there is something blocking others from access to it. So will I take responsibility for what I can control in this moment to make life better for those who need access? And so in that sense, I think that's what we have to see ourselves as, is that we've inherited this country and these systems. And while I'm not to blame for making a racialized society, I am responsible in this moment for doing what I can to rectify it as much as possible. And again, I can't do it alone. Like, we have to do it together and make choices to change that together. And so, you know, I think a lot of times some voices want to say, oh, don't make me feel guilty, I didn't choose this. Or, you know, they'll say like, I didn't enslave anybody. And yes, that's true. But now we've inherited a society that does treat groups differently. So what can we do to hear those cries and then to hopefully make it better for all, so that all can actually live into some of those values of the United States that were written in some of our founding documents, right? The pursuit of, or, you know, that all are created equal in the pursuit of liberty and justice for all. Can we live into those values even more? And I think we can. And I think that it is worth the shot, worth the effort in that sense.
Mm. Wow. I love your analogy of the hotel. I love that.
Yeah, me too. The whole, like, I didn't build it that way. One of the follow-up questions to your talk about the racialization of our society. You know, there are some people who would prefer not to engage with some of these histories because they say that it demonizes white people, that they're saying like, oh, now I have to be ashamed or embarrassed or apologetic about being white. How would you respond to that, you know, that worry about critiques of white Christian nationalism?
Yeah. You know, that's a tough one. Because again, I want to make clear and recognize that yes, like, most white Americans today did not personally enslave or, you know, choose to suppress or, you know, depress certain groups. I get that. But when we're talking about shame and feeling ashamed, when I look at the fact that if I had been born in the South, let's say, in a sundown town, in the early 1900s, that was where, you know, lynchings took place, and they took place on Sundays outside of churches or in town squares. And there were thousands of white folks that would show up to that. And for me to sit here and think that I couldn't have been a part of that number, I think is kind of prideful, right? To think that I would have, you know, been set apart or whatever. I would have recognized it right away. Well, there were a lot of well-meaning white Christians that just followed along and went along with it. And if there's a history that we should be ashamed of, those are stories that I think we should be. So, you know, I went to grad school at Baylor University and read about the lynching of Jesse Washington while I was in grad school there. And I describe it in the book a bit. Basically, the goal that I had as an author is to kind of stun the reader, right, at the absolute inhumanity of the mob, and to recognize this were thousands of people in the town that I was now living. And these were folks that went to church, and what they did to this human was indescribable in some sense and absolutely inhumane. People didn't treat their animals this cruel, and this was a human. And so in that sense, yeah, maybe we should be ashamed, right? Maybe that would be kind of helpful to say, wow, like, we could have been a part of that, because a majority of folks went right along with it. And so maybe we need to wrestle with that and sit with that, for a while, that unease, right? I don't think we should just push through that. We should really face full on the inhumanity of some of our history, because, yeah, the famous quote, those who ignore it are doomed to repeat it. And so how are we repeating it now? How is this being relived now? And I think for me, I have fear that I recognize in my own life. I don't want to be a part of the group that possibly is doing this. Or, you know, to think about Martin Luther King Jr., he kind of calls out the white moderates, right, in his letter from a Birmingham jail.
He sure does.
I do not want to be a white moderate. I'm afraid of that because I see how that does block a whole group, right? They were blocking a whole group of people from being able to move into living in a country and in a, just not even, you know, over and above white Americans, but just to be treated equally, right? Yeah. It wasn't as though they wanted to keep others from accessing the good of civil society. They just wanted to be a part of it as well. And so, yeah, I think, you know, Kelly, it's difficult, but these things are difficult and they are messy. But I think there could be a time where, yeah, maybe white Christians need to just sit with for a while the discomfort and recognize that we easily could have been a part of that history. And so now taking seriously, what does that mean for us as we move forward?
Mm-hmm. So that goes to three of the other seven difficult questions in the preface. You ask, can we be faithful Christians and critique the United States? Can we be faithful Christians and patriotic? And can we be faithful Christians and celebrate this country and our citizenship? So I love that you tease each of the questions out separately for the points, but to what you were just talking about in your own study of history, how do you answer that? Can we be faithful and critique the U.S. and be patriotic and celebrate our country and our citizenship?
Yeah, I think to all those, and I try to point that out too, and you know, throughout the book, especially in the next chapter from the premise in the first chapter, where the answer is yes, right? So can we be faithful Christians and critique the U.S.? I think and be patriotic, these are intertwined, that patriotism can be defined as a love of your fellow countrymen and women, right? And a warmth towards where you're at and the people that you're around. But I see that as it doesn't have to exist over and above caring for those who are not your countrymen and women. In fact, it shouldn't be. But if you care for something, wouldn't you tell the truth about it? You can't say that you are in a loving relationship with a spouse or a brother, sister, or a parent, and or a child and never tell them the truth, right? In some ways, that is unloving. And so to be, I think, a faithful Christian and American and to be patriotic, it means we need to look at the good and the bad. And again, I'm not here to say that no good has ever been done in this country or by this country, mm-hmm. or that Christians have always been on the side of, you know, pain and anguish for other groups. But so often, there's a desire to only paint Christians or Christianity in a positive light. But I think, again, that doesn't tell the truth about this history. And if we want to do better, you know, between ourselves and to others around us, we have to recognize that we can be a part of things and have been a part of things that are really dark. And so we don't have to just look at one or the other. But right now, I think we need to look closely at the ways that we have hurt and marginalized those in the past, because embracing Christian nationalism does that to folks now, right, in the present. And so I think in learning from our past and recognizing what was taking place, hopefully that equips us to look with clear eyes around us in this current moment and think through, well, who is being marginalized? Whose cries are not being heard? How are we participating in social groups and movements and systems that perpetuate that? And then how can we change that, right? What do we need to do to move away from that so that we're not committing again these same mistakes, right? Where 60, 70 years from now, folks will look back and wonder, how could they have done that? Why were they doing that? Hopefully we can all be a part of moving towards a future where there's less pain, right? That we're a part of seeking the good and flourishing of all those around us.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a both and. It's not an either or. That's the one thing it for me has really been a challenge, is to change my worldview to hold that both and, which if you read anything in the, that's my takeaway from the Gospels in particular. This guy named Jesus had that capacity to do the both and it's just, it's not a natural instinct, I think, for us humans to have that ability. We do either or. Binary works really well. My point being is that it's just how we live in our culture. We want to see things as right, wrong, good, bad, yes, no, you know, all of that. And to, you're asking us to be, to lift up a little bit and be both and in those. To that end, also, I mean, to finish through the difficult questions here, you bring out another one. If the United States is a Christian nation, a beacon of hope and democracy to the world, why do we often treat immigrants and refugees with such disdain and sometimes outright violence? Why don't we do more to help them? And we live right in the middle of this. We've been seeing this now for, you know, it's, this is not new, but it's been, it's getting worse, it feels like, than getting better. And I wrestle with that question. How does somebody who say that they are Christian do what they do? And I know in this, just in the last few minutes, we've been talking about from a U.S. perspective, right? But being a Christian means it's more than that, right? It's a universal concept. And the, you know, if you identify with the universal Christ, so at least keep it at a global level, like on our little, you know, rock here that we share. The, it seems like you can only be Christian if you were born here. Like, it doesn't matter if you're a Christian outside of the country, you are absolutely less than, and you're not allowed in here. It's only, we're only going to let you in if we say it's okay. And I don't get that. That just blows my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think that's one of the things with, as I study Christian nationalism, it really is focused on creating categories of us and them, right? And really clearly defining who's in the in-group and who's in the out-group. And so often that falls along ethno-racial lines, right? We, by our skin color or the language folks speak, right, we're able to quickly determine, are they one of us or not? And the surprising and saddening thing that we find is that white American Christians are less likely to accept immigrants or refugees, even if they're fellow Christians, right? They really empirically are more likely to say, no, they shouldn't come here. They shouldn't be here. So it's not even a religious question. It really is this kind of ethno-racial question. And so to that, when I look at the Gospels, when I look at some of the themes, you know, of Jesus' life and ministry and commands, to me, that just seems completely opposed, right? Those two can't coexist. And so then it's, yeah, what work do we need to do to try to disentangle the Christian nationalism from other expressions of Christianity and recognizing there isn't just this one, that this is the answer, but that there are many that are confronting and opposing some of those elements of Christian nationalism, and how can we move towards these other expressions?
Well said. Okay, so Andrew, you've got one more on the list here, and it's not an easy one. It is, can we be grateful for this country without baptizing and rationalizing away all the evil perpetuated in its name? Now, that's a big ask.
So. Yeah, it is. It is. And I think, you know, with all these trying to set the table for the rest of the book, you know, it really is trying to locate these questions in our hearts and minds and then kind of unwinding those, right? So then through other parts, really look full on into the darker aspects of it and to look exactly why this is taking place, what was happening, what are, you know, the aspects of Christian nationalism that I think played into these darker aspects. And I think we can be grateful, right, that there are positive aspects of living here, right? I mean, we live in relative safety. Now, that's not equally distributed. There are other groups in other parts of the country where it isn't as safe. And so I don't want to just make this blanket statement. But comparatively, you know, there are many good things here. Now, we're in a moment, political moment, where democracy is being really kind of pulled apart at the seams. And it's an open question as to what it'll look like in 1 year, 3 years, 4 years. And so we need to be aware of that. But for the most part, there are a lot of, you know, aspects and characteristics about living here that are wonderful, especially when we look historically. But that doesn't mean that it's perfect or it's been anywhere near perfect. And so I think, again, it's just holding those two things in tension with one another and recognizing that this isn't a wholesale demonization of everything you know, that people care about. But trying to say, well, if you care about it, well, then you have to tell the truth about it. And then recognize that it isn't perfect, but that we're constantly remaking these things, this world, right? And that we can put it, we can remake it in a direction that hopefully moves us away from some of the harm that has been perpetuated. And we need to believe that we can do that and be a part of that work. And I think ultimately, you know, since I'm writing to Christians, to say that's the work that we're called to, is to recognize that we are to work together towards a shared future where it can be improved. So again, going back to the early church example, the apostles shouldn't have just said, well, you know, I don't know about these widows and what they're arguing about, or maybe they should just leave if they don't like it here. They didn't say that. Mm-hmm. Right? They recognized that this was a group in need and that they could do better. And then they endeavored to do better. And so let's do that. Let's hear the cries. Let's look at the darker aspects and recognize that, you know, we could go to the same place if we're not careful. So then how can we do better? And so I think that's the tension we need to live in.
Yeah. Well said. Well, those are seven difficult questions that we should all ask. Kelly, go ahead.
Indeed. Well, I was just going to say on the heels of that, what are some directions that Christians could go? You know, if somebody's listening to this and go, well, what else should I do? Everything I've done so far is what my pastor has taught me to do, what my family's taught me to do, what I feel like I've needed to do to protect my faith and hold on to my freedom of religion or whatever. What are some directions that those Christians could take, or it's practical actions they could make to start to, I guess, reverse reduce some of the harm?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a big question. So part of it that I try to do throughout the book is looking at the different idols of Christian nationalism. So power, fear, and violence, and recognizing how those play such a role in how Christianity operates in the U.S. And it's so easy to fall into those different traps. But in the book too, trying to highlight the stories of folks, basically examples of expressions of Christians moving to confront and oppose, you know, any of these or all three of these idols in the worlds around them. And so, you know, with this, I offer those examples as merely examples, saying, and for me, trusting in the creativity of Christians, right, as they confront whatever it is that's unique to their situation, whether it's their community or state, their skill set, the groups they're a part of, the networks that they're in. That they can be creative. So recognizing these idols and how they can pull us away from expressing the gospel as Jesus expressed it. And then thinking creatively of how they can live out into that. So stories of congregations that really work to, you know, pool together money, and then to give it away to groups that could invest it in, you know, African-American communities and causes. Recognizing that so much of our history has taken from these groups, right? And that was unique to their situation and where they were moving as a congregation, but then they acted. They acted right in the moment. And so that's one story. Or another story is a friend of mine who works, started a nonprofit and works to integrate refugees to her community into the community. And, you know, in meeting one refugee, recognizing that there's a significant hurdle to getting a driver's license in the state, because while she could take the test in a native language, the manual was only offered in English. And so it wasn't that this woman wasn't working hard or trying her best, but she had a significant hurdle. But then my friend recognized that this woman is a part of a community. There are others facing this exact same hurdle. So instead of only teaching this woman English, she went to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles in the state and said, you should offer manuals in other languages. And so now she's thinking at that community systemic level and solving a problem in meeting a person where they were, but for a whole group of people. And so I think those are examples of Christians recognizing how we fall short of loving our neighbors. And how easy it is to ignore those cries for help, because again, everything's working for us. But in the moment, you know, seeing that need and then recognizing that this is part of a broader need for a whole community of people. And how can we be a part of loving and being good neighbors to this whole group? So throughout, the book, I try to offer those examples.
I have a question for you right off of this. So that's a great way to look at the what you didn't use this phrase, but it sounds like you're describing the moderate Christian who Kelly, I think, is your archetype here, who is not a Christian nationalist, doesn't fit that category, but they really do wonder what can I do to be a part of the solution? What does the moderate do with the Christian nationalist?
Well, I think, in some ways, where what we see empirically is that most Americans are somewhere in the middle, right? Most Americans do not strongly embrace Christian nationalism, and most do not strongly reject it, but they resist it to an extent or have mixed feelings about it, or are somewhat sympathetic to it, because for many Americans who are either nominally or Christian, they would say, well, if any religion is kind of elevated in our country, it might as well be Christianity, right? And based on our history, they, just kind of assume that. And I get it. I can understand the logic of that thought. But I think what our research shows, and that I think is really important for Christians to recognize, and that, again, that kind of brings the fear to me of being a moderate Christian, is that many times, being just kind of in the middle or in moderation creates fertile ground for that extremism to take root and then grow and flourish and bloom, right? So it's the folks that don't say anything that allows those that are maybe strongly embracing it, who speak very loudly, to go unopposed and to say that, well, maybe I'm not the one trying to enact legislation to put In God We Trust in all schools. But if I stay quiet and allow those who are pushing for that legislation to be the only voice, to be the only Christian voice that anybody hears, right, then that allows for that to move forward and to be unopposed. So I think for me, as I look at myself and then too, as I, try to share with others, based on research, is that it's those Christians who maybe are moderates or, somewhat sympathetic. We need them to start saying, right, no, we can't lift Christianity above others because it creates this harm. And that's why, throughout the book, I try to share a lot of that empirical evidence, is that even if you are sympathetic to it, it can pull you in directions that I think Christians don't want to be pulled in, but maybe they're just not aware to. And so how can we move towards confronting and opposing Christian nationalism so that we're not caught in that middle that, again, allows for that extremism to take root and then to one day bloom and harm other communities?
Yeah. So it sounds like the answer there is something like is you kind of have to take a position. And, I just pulled up a Bible verse here, Colossians 3:16. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly as you teach and admonish one another with all wisdom. Like, this might be a chance for the moderate or left-leaning Christians to admonish those that are further right.
Yeah. Well, and I think, sometimes what's so helpful, and I actually love Colossians. That's one of the books of the Bible that really, I think, engages me in this broader, understand this broader, engagement with Christian nationalism. And in a lot of ways, when we take a moderate or a silent position, so often that can be co-opted as tacit support for those who want to push Christianity to the forefront. And so it is, to say, well, I will opt out. I'm not going to be a part of this fight. That you can do that when you're in a privileged position. When the politics aren't coming down on you and your community, you can say, well, I will be apolitical. But to stand with the marginalized, to stand with those who are being crushed, means that we're going to be choosing a side, because those folks don't get a choice, right? They're on the receiving end of something and they don't have a choice. And that's so right. I think there's right. So I think as for me as a white Christian man, Protestant man, yeah, if I'm silent or say, well, I'll just opt out, that's because there probably aren't any laws, you know, being passed or pushed that will dramatically affect my life. And that's a life of relative privilege. And so I think we have to really start looking at it in terms of the, yeah, look at it from that angle, I think hopefully helps us to see, well, what can we do and how and why is that important?
Yeah, great. You know, because here we are, for the folks that are not watching the video of this. So here, the audio portion of this, three white guys talking about,
right.
What is, white privilege essentially, but let's be honest, it is what it is. And it's a fairly new concept, for our culture, right? Because, you know, where I grew up in the Midwest, we didn't talk about things like this. It's only been within the heck, even for me, for the only last maybe 5-7 years tops that I've even knew what that meant, or I knew the phrase white privilege, let alone now spending the last several years really picking it apart, deconstructing it, realizing, oh yes, I definitely have a life of white privilege. And I have to do something with it, right? Not only do I have to acknowledge it, but then because it comes with inherent power, I can do good things with it. Like I can actually use it. And not it, because there are folks that simply cannot have a voice. They don't have a seat at the table. So then therefore it's called upon us to actually act together to bring that. And to your point about choosing a side, yeah, I want to be on this side of that. I'm going to bring something up in that I'm not a big fan of this person, but, you mentioned him in here and kind of want to dig in from a theological point about Christian nationalism. So I'm referring to Albert Mohler, who, for our listeners who don't know him, he is the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville. He's been there for, like almost 30 years. He took that role on when he was in his 30s, as I recall. And he has, if he's not the mastermind, he is certainly one of the masterminds that has shaped what is the direction and theology of the Southern Baptist denomination over the last 30 years through his work and through the denominations and what you see going on through their different churches. The point now I'm getting to, though, is you say that he knows about that he knew years ago that Christian nationalism was going to be an issue, but yet really didn't do anything about it.
Yeah. So post January 6th, I listened to his podcast that he does maybe daily.
Yeah.
It's at least weekly, yes. But I think daily. Yeah. Likely. And he was talking about what happened there. Obviously, he decried the violence, which was good to see. And then, you know, he talked about the Christian symbolism that was there and talked about how that was, you know, grieved him, which I was in agreement with that. And he talked about how, you know, there are kingdoms of this world and the kingdom of God, and those are different. And I thought that was in line too. I agreed with that. But then he talked about how Christian nationalism, or, you know, this kind of intersection of Christianity with this political push, said, well, that is fringe. Like, this definitely doesn't represent a lot of evangelical Christianity. And that was where I had to say, well, actually, no, right? So we have empirical evidence that, no, this is central to white evangelical Christianity. This is a big deal. This is something that we all have to wrestle with if you're Christian in America. And so that's where I think he was wrong. But then what we found is a year later, when he recounted that episode on January 6, 2021, he talked about the insurrection, but then he really kind of ignored or skipped over the Christian symbolism. So right after he engaged with it, which was good, but then he tried to say, well, this is just fringe. But a year later, he really kind of just ignored all of that. And so I, you know, used him as an example of how easy it is for us then to just say, well, I don't know if that was necessarily true. Should we really even worry about it anymore? And I'm trying to say, yes, we should. This is still an issue. But then 6 months after, you know, that 1 year anniversary, then he was quoted as kind of embracing Christian nationalism, right? Because he saw it as something that would make the left, quote unquote, unhappy. And so I thought this was yet another kind of step in that journey that was to me, you know, it grieved me that, you know, he would then want to embrace that term when we find that is, you know, associated with so many things that really do harm, you know, other groups, racial, ethnic minorities, refugees, immigrants, all of those things. And so, yeah, I think he was just an example to highlight, you know, on one end, how some evangelicals are responding. And then there are other conservative, politically conservative folks who are responding in a different way, who are trying to confront and oppose Christian nationalism. And so trying to say that this isn't just, you know, on the spectrums of political or religious, you know, theology or political views, some sort of progressive conservative dichotomy, but that folks can be politically conservative and still confront and oppose Christian nationalism, because it's going to take a lot of us. I think it's going to take all of us. And so trying to find folks who will work with us wherever we find ourselves, I think is really important. And again, recognizing everybody is on a journey and they're coming in at a different point. And so we can't expect folks to just emerge, you know, right where we're at, or wish that they just understood it more quickly, because these are difficult, really deep issues. And so the more that we can work together on them with patience, and not in trying to say that we shouldn't act now for those who are marginalized and being crushed, we should. But it doesn't mean that we have to berate folks or make them feel less than if they aren't quite where we are. So I feel like we can act from where we feel convicted at the moment we do, and then hopefully encourage other folks to continue on their journeys, and hopefully they join us.
Yeah, I like that, right? You know, we don't, you know, it's often said, meet folks where they are. And this is a great example that we won't agree on everything, but yet we can agree on some things that are fundamental, and we can appreciate the necessity, one of which is Christian nationalism being what it is. And I think, Kelly, you had a question that you posed was, is Christian nationalism growing or shrinking? Mm.
Yeah, so it's really interesting kind of data what we're finding, that the Americans that strongly embrace Christian nationalism, that group is actually getting smaller over time. So over the last 10 to 15 years, was around 19-20% by one measurement, Christian nationalism, now around 14-15%. So it is getting smaller. The number of Americans that are sympathetic to Christian nationalism is staying pretty steady. So again, it's that group that may stay quiet, right, and not actively oppose Christian nationalism, but will be silent. So again, there's issues there with that. But I do think what we find is that while this group is getting smaller, one of the implications of that for smaller social groups is that the identity markers that set them apart from those outside their group become even more salient the smaller this group gets. So they're more likely to see each other and themselves as this remnant, right, of defending a Christian America. And so that becomes even more on the forefront of how they think about their group and what their vision for the United States. So while the group is smaller, as a share of the voting population, it's bigger than it is in the population itself. And this is a very salient identity to it. And so that's something to keep in mind as well, right? This is very, very much at the forefront of how they're thinking about and seeing their place in the world and what they do and how they do it, and think about and hope for the United States.
Yeah.
It's interesting how you see that play out practically in, you know, trying to pass laws that restrict people from voting, or to, you know, really embrace the electoral college because it leans toward, right, you know, a minority having a voice over a majority. You see that they're like this ragtag band of rebels that are finally, you know, they're holding on to the one true way.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
You know, we're getting close to ending this time. And Andrew, thank you very much for this. This has been a great conversation. And I hope our listeners find as much value in this as I have. We can't leave, though, without, you know, acknowledging what has just happened recently with Mike Johnson being elected by the Republican Party as the Speaker of the House. And we are learning daily now that there's more and more to him about his spiritual beliefs and religious tenets, I guess. And he sounds like a Christian nationalist. So I'm going to ask you a two-part question. First of all, what is the definition of a Christian nationalist?
Yeah, so Christian nationalism, we define as a cultural framework, which is made up of narratives and symbols and values and beliefs that advocates for a close fusion of a particular expression of Christianity with American civic life. Mm-hmm. And it wants the government to perpetuate and vigorously defend this particular expression of Christianity as the central cultural framework of the United States. And so again, that particular expression of Christianity brings with it a host of other cultural beliefs. So it isn't just that, you know, like kind of historic Christian beliefs of Jesus is the savior and that we need to put our trust in him and that God will save the world through Jesus through various modes right across Christianity. People believe different things. So it's not just that, but also these other cultural beliefs and elements. And that gets added into it. So it becomes this cultural package that people embrace and has a very particular, influence on how they see their social worlds. I think expressed through Mike Johnson, we can see in his life and writings a lot of examples of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with a colleague, you know, I wrote, you know, a bit on that too, to kind of highlight how he provides an example of Christian nationalism to kind of highlight that definition, what it is, right? What are the elements of it?
Well said.
Thank you so much for all these insights and putting it in perspective and, you know, and also giving, you know, some food for thought for people who are listening, thinking like, what can I do? So, so thank you so much for being here today. We really appreciate it.
Oh yeah, definitely. Thank you. I really enjoy the conversation and hope it continues, right? And this is, a lot of the work that we need to keep doing.
Well, Andrew, thank you very much. So, all right, folks. So, an amazing book. I cannot recommend this enough. It's called American Idolatry. Andrew Whitehead. You can find it on Amazon and all kinds of sources. Mm-hmm. It's actually a great quick read. It's not, you know, a 1,000-page tome or anything else like that. In fact, I think the main book is about 190 pages plus the notes in it. So, I encourage you to grab a copy and read it.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right, Andrew.
And it's the audio version is also really great. Oh, the narrator is awesome.
Gee, who is the narrator?
That was a fun experience. It was really, wild to be a part of that. I'm so glad I was able to do it. But if you wanted to hear me read the book, the audio book, and if you don't mind also too, I recorded with someone helped me, but I recorded a 4-part series on Christian nationalism. It's a podcast. And so it's called American Idols and people can download it wherever they get their podcasts. But it does break this out of what is Christian nationalism? How does it threaten democracy? How does it threaten Christianity? And then what's coming next and where do we go from here? So they could check that out too. Alongside the book, I think they kind of work well as companion.
It sounds like awesome. They do. Andrew, thank you for sharing that. Yeah. All right, folks. We're going to wrap up another episode of Radical Love Live. And thanks again for listening. Thanks for listening to this episode of Radical Love Live, co-hosted by Mark Dilcom and Kelly Wilson. All rights reserved. You can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, and other popular podcast platforms. Go to radicallovelive.com to learn more about us, watch recordings of our live events, and listen to our podcast. We also invite you to check out what Kelly and Mark are doing by going to our websites. Find Kelly at kellywilson.com and Mark at markdilcom.com. This is Radical Love Live, where we explore faith outside the boxes.